He is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He's a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum at 6 p.m. for Bagrum on Law and Life, 101.9 High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Hi, thank you for joining us this evening. I really appreciate it. It's Michael Bagrum every Tuesday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. I really appreciate you tuning in. Like every Tuesday evening, we have a wonderful guest who I'll introduce just now. But as I do every single Tuesday, I look at a book and I introduce the book that I've been trying to read during the week. Now, this week, I've had an issue. The latest employment figures have come out, the QES, and those figures are showing really bad news. We're losing at least 25,000 jobs a day, and unfortunately, it's getting worse. And I was speaking to one of my colleagues in Parliament this morning who said it's really up to the education, because we're still desperate to bring foreigners into the country to do certain jobs when we don't have qualifications and we don't have the ability to do those jobs. And its bottom line is education. And I remember reading a book by Jonathan Janssen. You all might have heard of Jonathan Janssen. He wrote a book about 10 years ago. Well, it's not actually a book. It's a series of columns. And it's by Jonathan Janssen, J-A-N-S-E-N. It says we need to act. And he was looking at the poor quality of education then. I don't think much has changed, unfortunately. He wrote other books who might ring a bell. It's called Great South African Teachers. We Need to Talk. Briva on My Kinnis, Letters to My Children. And he wrote a column, a weekly column at the Times, every single Wednesday. Not anymore, but he used to at the time. And this is a collection of many of his columns as to what was wrong with the education system then and what he believed should be done to try and improve it. So it's not just a rant and it's not just a complaint, but it's an outline of what has to be done. I'm going to give my copy to the Minister of Education, hopefully next week, when I see her, and ask her to have a look at some of those columns. I found it really interesting. It was written in 2013, and most of the columns were from 2012. So as you can see, it's an old book, but really worth delving into. So I recommend that people have a look at it. The nice thing about it is you can read one or two columns, put it down, and come back to it a day later and read the next column. It's really worthwhile. Okay, so like I do every week, I have a wonderful guest, and I'm very lucky this evening to have Mr. Eddie Oblowitz, who's a friend of mine. I've known Eddie, I think, since nursery school. Yep. I sit next to him, in fact, in Sub A at Hertzler School. We had a wonderful teacher, Mrs. Bernstein, who used to make me read. I didn't like reading in those days. I think she's engendered that now into me, where I try and read a book a week. But Mrs. Bernstein made me read a book called Dunno, about a little kid who, whenever was asked a question in class, he used to answer Dunno. It was a lovely book. And I had Eddie sitting next to me. I might tell one or two stories, naughty stories about Eddie, but he's going to tell us a little bit about his career since he left school, take us through some of the interesting things he's done. I know that I've interacted with Eddie over the years, and in particular, and one of his clients will remain unnamed, and an interesting exercise I had there. So Eddie today is the owner of Continuo Financial Services. He advises many high net worth South Africans and international families and their family offices, their entities, and he holds appointment as non-executive director of several listed and non-listed companies, as well as being a trustee and a protector to various trusts. Eddie's career, and we're going to hear a bit about it from him, is over 45 years, where he included in serving as an international partner at Arthur Andersen, and he worked in a senior position in the offshore trust and wealth management segment. Eddie, I got that very short CV from a long career that you've held. I got that from your kind secretary, Julia Leibovitz, who always answered me. It was when I was nagging and nagging to get you on air on Chai FM, she eventually found a slot for me. So thank you, and very big thanks to Julia Leibovitz, who pushed you into this. I think I had the sense that you were reluctant, but I'm very pleased with you with us this evening. So Eddie, just tell us a little bit about the career. Expand a bit on that very short one paragraph CV. I normally get 20 pages from people. Tell me a bit about your life and your business since school.
Okay. Well, firstly, can I call you Bags? Because that's the only name.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Bags, thank you very much for inviting me, and shalom and good afternoon to all the Chai FM listeners. It's a great privilege to be asked to be interviewed by you and to be on this particular radio show. So yes, I've known you for 63 years since Gaverachana's nursery school in Schoender Street Schuld. And the other claim to fame that I've got before we delve into my, let's call it professional exploits, is that I sit next to you in the same row in Schuld, at the Garden Schuld. So those are really my fame, my claim to fame. And I just need to tell the listeners before you go off at a tangent maybe and tell about my exploits, that never in my wildest dreams did I ever envisage that whilst we were at school together and all those naughty things that you got up to, that you would attain such heights that you have, both in the community and in terms of your civic responsibilities, ending up as an MP. And and even less so interviewing me on a Jewish radio show. So that let's just put that into context. So yes, I have had and do have a very varied and interesting and meaningful and satisfying professional career. And in addition to the various components, I'm pleased that I also have sufficient time to devote to communal endeavors, which is so important because, as you know, we cannot just take from society. We need to give back. And to me, that's an important element of my life in terms of the world that we live in. So of all the components of my work, and they are all, as I say, very meaningful and satisfying to me, dealing with local, international, high net worth families, there's never a dull moment, okay? And we've all heard of the phrase of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. In fact, it's a universal saying, no matter which country or culture you come from. And I just want to share with you and the listeners a story. It's not a story, it's a factual situation of how the richest family in the world went broke. And that is the Vanderbilt family. And the family patriarch, Cornelius Vanderbilt in the United States, he managed to transform a simple $100 that he borrowed from his mother into a $100 million fortune by the time of his death in 1877. His inheritance to his family at that time was more than the entire reserves of the U.S. Treasury that they held at that time. So that was a giant. Yeah. But Bags, what happened is in less than a single generation, the surviving Vanderbilts had spent the vast majority of their wealth, and their wealth was virtually gone in its entirety within four generations. In fact, in 1973, they had a family reunion at Vanderbilt University. It was attended by about 120 family members. Not one of them in attendance was even a US dollar millionaire by that stage. And as a side anecdote, many of our listeners, I'm sure, have heard of the CNN anchor Anderson Cooper. Now, Anderson Cooper, who's on CNN right now, is the great, great, great grandson of Cornelius Vanderbilt, and he inherited nothing from his mother's Vanderbilt line. He started his career from scratch. So, Bags, you say to yourself, how is it possible that a guy that had accumulated more wealth than the entire U.S. Treasury, how did it happen? Well, very simply put, they went from producers or creators of great wealth to great consumers of it. So, you know, in all the work that I do with families intergenerationally, in terms of intergenerational succession planning, is the most critical, because risk associated with families, they often don't recognize their biggest risk. When I ask families, when I meet them for the first time, what is your biggest risk? They go off at a tangent, you know, in terms of asset allocation, diversification, currencies, jurisdictions, etc., etc. But they often leave off the list the biggest risk. And they say to me, but what is the biggest risk that we've left off? And I said, you yourselves as a family are your biggest risk yourself, because they focus instead on focusing on the human capital balance sheet, they focus their most of the time on the material wealth balance sheet, and they don't take stock of,
and things of which they got no control of.
Well, some they do have control of. They certainly, in terms of family dynamics, there is control, and wealth, you know, especially extreme wealth. I look upon it as like a magnifying glass, because it shows up every one of a person's weaknesses and sometimes strengths too. So wealth can either be a positive or a negative influencer, but it's never a neutral, to use a colloquial term, it's never pyrrhic. It's either positive or negative. And Bags, the biggest problem is that wealth incorrectly handled, incorrectly dealt with, mixed with incorrect or misaligned human dynamics, can easily become a toxic cocktail. I'm reminded of that staying in Leo Tolstoy, the famous Russian author, in his famous book, Anna Karenina, where he says, quote, all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Just think about it.
Yeah.
Each one has got its own Taurus factor, for want of a better word, because of misapplied focus on not planning for and actioning family unity and continuity of family legacy and values. Money without values, without meaning, is nothing. So that this area of my professional existence is to me the most satisfying, because sometimes families have got this misbelief that, oh, I've got a will, I've got trusts, I've got people, you know, I don't have to worry about when I'm dead, you know, things will carry on. Not so. The creator of the wealth, it's the responsibility of the creator of the wealth to do certain things during their lifetime that cannot just somasua happen by chance post their demise. And, you know, you've got sometimes people, we all suffer sometimes from it, that the illusion that, you know, either we're going to live forever, we're immortal, or we're infallible. And by the way, so what if I leave a mess? The next generation can sort it out. So there requires to be considered planning. And it's not planning for a once-off thing. Large families, and today with added complexity of families, you take most South African families, Jewish families in particular. You've got a family maybe part living in Johannesburg.
Eddie, can I intervene? We've got to pay the bills now for one minute.
Okay, that's good.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Thank you. Thanks. We're with our guest this evening, Eddie Oblowitz, and Eddie is giving us a little bit of the philosophy behind where his career has led him to today. I'm going to cut in there and take him backwards a little bit to tell us about his travel. First through to university, what he studied, where did he work, and where did he get those skills that are today culminated in him protecting family wealth. So Eddie, just go backwards a little bit, and I'm sorry to do this to you and cutting in, but
no problem.
Go backwards. I presume you went to the University of Cape Town. I wasn't with you then.
No, because you went
off on my own path.
Yes,
I was a rodent. Yeah,
you went to Rhodes. So I was at, while you were a rodent doing your thing there, I was at Mosque on the Hill, as they referred to UCT at the time. But predating that, of course, I went to Herzliya School, which provided me with a very good education, not only a Jewish education, but a very much broader education in how to think and how to handle situations. And UCT, I went the Bachelor of Commerce route and then did the Chartered Accountant route and worked for Arthur Andersen, did my articles. And I thought, well, you know, as traditionally happens, that you think you've got a termed horizon, that you do your articles and you go out and into the big wide world. Well, I actually stayed with Andersen for 21 and a half years, and it was really an extremely interesting career, you know, rising up to become an international partner. But that also provided the platform for the work that I do now and that I was referring to in terms of the intergenerational wealth advice, that family office advice that I give, insofar that I had clients, and the Johannesburg Stock Exchange in those days, in the 80s and 90s, had quite a plethora of companies that were controlled by families. They're obviously on the way out now. They're certainly not in vogue. A lot of the families have sold out and emigrated, either because their family or because their children weren't interested in the business, whatever the reasons were. But I and the rules also, of course, professional rules were different in those days in terms of independence regarding auditors. So when you became the auditor of the public company, you did the whole bank shoot right up to the family-owned controlling companies. So you got to know the families, and I used to listen to the likes of the late Jack Golden of Clicks fame, the likes of the late Raymond Ackerman, people that were really pioneering in terms of their endeavors in business, great business people. And that led me to having a burning interest for what, as exciting as the companies were, the family dynamics and the inputs required in terms of advising family, that the mixture of empathetic advice, understanding the basics, understanding the how the family fits together, and matching that with business principles, with accounting principles, with legal principles, whatever they were, to me was a very exciting space. And long story short, now going right through to further on, after a period of semi-retirement for 4.25 years, five families backed me, and in my own very niche practice of advising them. One thing led to another. I also got onto public listed company boards overseas as well. And then I folded my practice into a very large multinational fiduciary and offshore company, wealth management company. And I left there 6 years ago, just over 6 years ago, and went out on my own. You know, people today in this field, they back the jockey, not the horse. So, you know, it's almost like the intimacy that you have with a very close service provider, a professional advisor. So that's just a very precise version of where I've got you to today. And then, you know, it's all word of mouth. One's reputation is everything in this business. And fortunately, I've got a wide range of different clients locally and internationally, which keeps me up to date, or implies I need to keep up to date with local as well as other jurisdictions in terms of what's going on there. Because typically, as I mentioned before the ad break, the typical family today, particularly in the Jewish community, but not privy to the Jewish community only, you've got family members, probably the, if I can call it, the older members of the family still residing in South Africa, in Johannesburg, and you've got a child living in Sydney, another child living in London, another child living in Toronto. So all of this introduces added complexity. The minute you you've got to go multi-jurisdiction, let alone the succession planning imperative becomes the most heightened generally when the third generation is on the scene, because then you're introducing cousins, you're introducing the in-laws, if you know what I'm trying to say, the sister-in-law, the brothers-in-law. Sometimes the cousins have never worked, they don't even know each other. So, you know, to use a legal term that you're aware of, as you go down the degrees of consanguinity in the family, almost like a pyramid, it becomes that much more complex. Then you've got to add in all the jurisdictional complexities. So whether it's tax laws, whether it's other laws, banking laws, then you've got to take into consideration that some children may not be as gifted as others, whether it is in terms of competence, whether it's in terms of livelihood, whether it's in terms of medical issues. So families, you know, the exciting thing is that everything happens with families. No matter what planning you may do, there's a limit to the planning you can do, because life in itself, society, generational change, these all influence the family and the dynamics. And of course, depending upon how the individuals grew up, that also molds them. Whether they were in a home that was extremely, you know, democratic, as opposed to a home that there was a dictator, a benevolent dictator, whether the children actually and the cousins actually got together or not. So there's always something going on in a family, whether it's births, deaths, divorce, immigration, selling off a business, a lawsuit, a tax inquiry, you know, selling, bringing professional management into a family-owned business. There's always something going on in a kind of a way. What fuels my element of professional advice is agitation, whether it's positive or negative agitation in a family that produces some sort of requirement for additional resource from me or other people. And, you know, the whole question about inheritance is often viewed in this myopic way of, what's in the will, I'll inherit. But it's far more than that, because there's a case of, are you inheriting wealth, as in dollars and cents? Well, the question I ask, or are you inheriting identity? Identity which includes values, includes almost like with the great book written by Maimonides, Moran Evochim, A Guide to the Perplexed. Is it something that's just a klomp geld, a lot of money, or have you got the base level foundational elements to be passed the baton over to future generations? And obviously, there's fear sometimes on both sides. Fear from the senior generation that the next generation won't be up to it, whatever that might mean in their eyes. And on the other hand, the succeeding generation faces unspoken pressures and you know, to become like my father or grandfather, to step per stairways into their shoes, to lead like they did, to preserve what they built. You know, these are all very foundational fears that people have. And legacies isn't something that is entrenched in stone. It's not something that's fixed, that you've got to take on, you've got to adopt. It's merely a platform, a foundation upon which to build with unique strengths. Everyone in a family should have their place in the sun. And the most successful wealthy people that transfer wealth successful intergeneration, they separate what I would call principal lines from personalities. So certain things are immutable. Certain values are immutable and cannot be changed over time. But in others, they remain core and they transcend time, place, and individuals. And that we can go on, you know, integrity, excellence, vision, being able to keep kindness, gemilut chasadim, helping other people, helping in your family, etc. And the successful transmitters of wealth, they distinguish from these principles, from personal styles. We all got different persona, and they honor the former while authentically expressing the latter. They learn to articulate the differences. And I often say there's a wonderful element in families. I call it the sameness of difference. We may come out the same room. We may come out from the same mishpocha, the same, you know, the same grandparents, etc. But you can be different to me. And I've advised the family, and the one brother was very entrepreneurial, never had any qualifications. The second brother was a highly skilled professional. The third brother, let's call it, if brains were taxed, he'd get a rebate. And then there was a sister who wasn't involved in the business, and I came up with a plan that they all had something to do, so that they didn't feel that even the one that was let's call it not directly involved in the business, that he did have a job in the business, that the sister didn't feel left out, and that's the thing, you know, fam, all elements of the family should be treated equally in terms of personality. Fairness is not equality in terms of dollars and cents. There's a very big difference. So, you know, this doesn't happen by chance. This all requires the courage to start the plan, to start the conversation of intergenerational succession. And as I said, it's iterative. It keeps evolves because society changes, families undergo change, business change, laws change. So you can't rule from the grave other than immutable values that we want to see that are handed down intergenerationally. You cannot have something, you cannot straitjacket a family. And amongst everything, I found poor communication amongst families is arguably the biggest root cause of family conflict. And interesting, people sometimes are more prone to pay lawyers' fees than actually be together in the same room to sort their differences out. And unless they're going to have clear, established channels of communication, that's where people like me and others come in, because we've got no baggage. I didn't steal your teddy bear when you were seven. Okay? I don't participate in the wealth. So I've, in a kind of a way, I've got a blue beret, and that I come in and I've got diplomatic immunity that I can say what I can say. The only thing you can do as a family, if you don't like what I say, is to fire me. But I come in objectively and I tell them that unless you sort this out in terms of having governance, in terms of having protocols and ongoing communication, it's highly likely that the lawyers and the courts will be seeing a lot of you and dissipating that wealth that your grandfather or the previous generations slogged so hard for to create. So these are just some of the basic elements to ensure successful intergenerational transfer.
Well, look, I understand that, and I just wanted to go backwards a little in the sense that bottom line of your grounding goes right back to your childhood. And you said that I didn't steal your teddy bear when I was seven, but I think a lot of it, and I started this conversation by referring to Jonathan Janssen's book and correcting the education system. A lot of it is also what people actually experience and learn those values, not only from the home, but from their friends, from their schools, from family. Those bottom line principles that you're talking about, the immutable values that you talk about, come from the school. I think a lot of it comes from the school. Obviously, you're with the family a lot of the time, but you do go out and you go to the school. Now, we were lucky, and within our community, both in Johannesburg and Cape Town, we had Jewish day schools that we could go to and could basically pick up a lot of those principles and listen to them and come out of it. Now, I only had the benefit of primary school. I went to another school afterwards, after Herzstedt School. But last night I went to the valedictory of the matrix at Herzstedt School. It was a wonderful evening. And listening to the prizes and the kids, well, they're not the young adults, listening to that was absolutely fantastic. And I was thinking, while you're talking about this, I was thinking about that is probably the foundation of a lot of what all of us went through as well. We didn't come from the same families, we didn't come from the same background, but a lot of us actually had the benefit of that external education as well. Eddie, we're going to cut off now, come off the platform, and then let's come in 1 minute.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Thank you. You're with Michael Bagram every single Tuesday evening between 6 and 7. Please tune in. Hi FM, wonderful program. We are interviewing a guest, a friend, a colleague, Eddie Oblowitz. He's taking us through some of his philosophy, some of the background to his career, and in particular, his values and what he tries to impart in not just looking after the wealth of high net worth individuals and companies, but looking after their life effectively, their financial life. And Eddie, just before we left off, I was praising some of the schooling that we got and some of the basically background that led into a lot of what we have become ourselves today. I just wanted to talk about an instance where you and I had a chance to work together, me as an attorney and you as an advisor. I had, during my career, involved myself with a businessman in Cape Town who had owned wine farms, etc., remained nameless. And he had, on occasion, he had other attorneys. He came to me to be second guest. In other words, when his attorneys told him something what he didn't like, I used to get this in the beginning. I used to get a fax and then a WhatsApp and eventually some phone calls from him to second guess his attorneys and to actually try and get around the advice that he didn't like. On one occasion, he asked me a question. He wanted me to check up on the opinion that he had received from corporate attorneys. And I came back and I said, what they've advised you is correct. Well, he lost his cool, started shouting at me, and explained that there's no ways he phoned me for me to agree with him. He wanted me to basically give him another way around it. And I said, well, I didn't understand it like that. And he said, well, you're not going to understand anything then. He was sort of quite shirty and rude. And I went back to it and I thought about it. And the next day I came back and I said, there is another way of basically skinning this cat and you could do X, Y, and Z. He said, aha, that's what I wanted to hear. And he put the phone down. He did pay me very handsomely for that. But fast forward, when he passed away, I think you were involved in running the trust or the estate.
Yeah, I was the executor. I was the executor of the estate and trustee of his trust, yeah.
And you then gave me a call, and I think basically on an instruction from him from the grave, I think he had left some indication somewhere that he was going to get an opinion from his attorneys. He wasn't going to like the opinion from his attorneys, and for someone, I can't remember who it was, but I know that you had phoned me and said, look, this is what has happened over here. The attorneys have advised you can't do that. You had to sell one of the farms, I think, and you better give us a way around it. And I immediately said to you, but there is no way around it. You can't do that. The law doesn't tell you that. It tells you X, Y, and Z, and they've told you X, Y, and Z. And you then said to me, well, I'm sure if he was around, he'd say, you better find a way. It then took me, I think it was about 10 months, working with a trade union to gild the lily somewhat, yeah, and to eventually come up with an answer that actually gave him what he wanted. So from the grave, he was telling me, I'm not accepting your bullshit, and I want you now to do X, Y, and Z, which we eventually did. I must admit, I was quite nervous through the exercise, but eventually the trade union agreed, and it worked out nicely. I don't know if you remember the story and whether you want to give us a bit of background to it.
I remember everything about that particular person, because it's larger than life and really changed the face of South African society in many ways. Pity there aren't too many of those, if I call it, characters left, in a positive sense. You know, South Africa's produced some wonderful and brilliant entrepreneurs. We've exported them. The late Donnie Gordon, the Donnie Gordon family, and what they do for South Africa, still do. And it just takes me on to another discussion point, and really, is this up your alley as an MP? Thank goodness for corporate South Africa. If it wasn't for corporate South Africa doing the job, the government should be doing at all levels, this country would be in Stock Street, as I say in the classics. South African corporates employ people. They pay their corporate taxes. They give their staff benefits. They give, in terms of the ESG, their environment, social, and governance, they give to society, to broaden society. They fix up roads. So I know it's anecdotally relevant.
But
to
it's working.
Saying.
It's working,
but
absolutely.
Thank goodness for corporate South Africa. In Johannesburg, whether it's the insurance cops, whether it's Discovery fixing up the potholes, whatever it is, corporate South Africa is really doing its job at levels far above what it's required to do. I just want to go back to a point you raised about values and you know, where you get it from. So, you know, us growing up in the 60s and 70s in South Africa, going to Jewish schools, where do you get values from? You get it from the home, okay? So home life is an important anchor. You supplemented by your schooling, and that's, as you refer to the Jonathan Jansen situation, is a big problem of South Africa. We're never going to eradicate crime and all the other ills if we do not have a proper educational system. If you look at, for example, countries north of us, that are far poorer, they were part of the colonial system. You go to Zimbabwe, you go to Zambia, the education is far better than us. And we've got all the might that we've got, and we cannot get that together. And then your community, and in our case, in the Jewish community, whether it's at shul, it's the youth movements, your chevra, all of that, your friends, they form an integral part of this potpourri of values. Of course, society has to change. So today, the pressure on these kids, we didn't have the TikTok generation. We didn't have cyberbullying. We didn't, if somebody threw you a punch at school and you'd land up in the headmaster's office and that was it. Invariably, it was localized to males, to boys fighting. Okay. Today, of course, the pressure on these poor kids is unbearable. And so all of this, plus dysfunctionality within families who don't have necessarily the glue that holds the family together. And yeah, you know, in terms, we don't have to look too far into our Jewish community in terms of the values that are entrenched in terms of how the father and the mother, but especially the mother, is the glue that holds the family together. You've today got, unfortunately, families that are misguided. It's part of society. So all of that impacts one's values. In fact, you can't inculcate values suddenly when somebody is a grandparent themselves. It's got to be like a tree nurtured from the beginning. So these all go into, let's call it, part of the mix of the communication that's required in this evolution, this iterative process to ensure successful succession planning, intergenerational transfer. And there are going to be times where people bang heads because obviously you come through different lenses. Your upbringing, your life's experience, which mold you, that creates your frame of reference. And as I say, it goes and colors the lens, the way you see the world, the way you see other people. and influences your dialogue. And then you add in the baggage that may have existed in terms of the broken communication in families. I mean, I've had a third generation person, pretty successful, say to me, I don't like how my grandfather made his money. I detest it. I said, well, you can't have it. You can't share it. You can't be a situation, have a situation where you detest your grandfather and the way he created the money. On the other hand, say, write me the check from the trust. That doesn't go together. It may be a difficult process, but you've got to go and try and meet, even if you don't meet halfway, or reach entire consensus. You're going to have some sort of ability to break down the roadblocks that happen along this process and along the way of this process. And keep the focus on the ultimate goal is really to keep family harmony, shalom bayit, unity based upon the family legacy, the values. And I always like having families as part of their governance documents to have a family value statement, whatever that might be, work ethic, sense of accountability, civility, community, friendships, loyalty, compassion, moral courage, whatever it is, tolerance. There's got to be some sort of swimming lines, guidelines, to be able to ensure that this family, as I say, that the family intergenerationally don't sway from it. And if they do, by the way, often I put in terms of the family governance documents, the family constitution, that if any member of the family in any way wishes not to follow, out of their own volition, not to follow the immutable values to be passed on intergeneration, then they actually almost adiate the responsibility, repudiate the responsibility to have that share in the gains of the family family wealth.
Eddie, can I just look a little bit beyond what we're talking about, and let's just talk a little bit about South Africa, because I look at it probably from an angle as a lawyer, and you're looking at it from an angle, a slightly different angle, and maybe as an accountant, maybe. Can we have a quick ad break, pay the bills, and let's hold on air?
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Thank you. Welcome back. You're with Michael Bagram on my normal Tuesday evening show between 6 and 7 on Tuesday evenings. I really appreciate you staying tuned in. We're with our wonderful guest, Eddie Oblowitz. Eddie's taken us through his career, taking us through some of his philosophy and some of his own values as to what he likes to import into the clients and making sure that he protects the future longevity of the wealth of that intergenerational family, intergenerational wealth. Eddie, I was just mentioning that I'm looking at the world through a slightly different prism, and you are also slightly different. The bottom line is something that we have inherited in this country, in South Africa. Now, a lot of us try and berate South Africa, say it's broken, it's destroyed, it's not a good place. We must get out of here. We must send our children away. And yet I find that the institutions, the legal institutions, our courts are working. Our courts are happy to talk truth to power. Our structures, our all legal framework is intact to a large degree. Yes, we keep reading about commissions where everyone's stealing and robbing and cheating and all that sort of thing, but we still got institutions, we've still got a network, we've got framework. Our accounting institutions are to a large degree world class. And I just wanted to hear about your comments on that, because we've got a country that can get back to its former glory, in the sense that, you know, we all had this dream when Mandela came into the first government in this country. I, for one, and I publicly say that, I voted for Mandela because I had that dream that we would build up into a strong, solid, basically a clear, forward-thinking country. There seems to have been a little bit of destruction, looting. That can be overcome. I just wanted to hear your comments on it, because you're there protecting generational wealth. And yet many of these people made their wealth through South Africa, in South Africa, and many of that the next generation remained to build up the businesses. How do you think, where are we going from here, and do you think we've still got our structures intact?
Yeah, so firstly, you're 100% right. From an accounting standard and business standards point of view, we are world class. I deal with, as I mentioned earlier, with some other jurisdictions, and they are slow in getting to our levels of accounting standards and governance, corporate governance. As you know, it was led by the charge was led by Justice King, Mervyn King, and so we were light years ahead of many, many so-called developed countries. So give a big tick to that. You're 100% right. Our courts work. I'm not so sure our prosecutorial elements work that well.
Yeah, well, okay, let's
Yeah,
say
look, our judges are impartial and work well. And then, of course, our banking and finance system is absolutely right up there with the with all, if I can call it, the AAA countries. In fact, our banking system is even better than some very well-known developed countries. So where is it that, as you are the pull-down factors, and you know, this is the big dilemma. We know that a lot of people, and just to connect back to a point that I raised earlier, you've got broken families, and I mean broken, disparate families all over the world. A large element of that started in the 60s, in the apartheid years, where after Sharpeville, as you know, a lot of people left, a lot of people left in after June 16 as well. And then people in anticipation of 1994 also left. So a lot of the wealth has, I mean, of extreme wealth has left South Africa. You may think that there's still people still live here. They don't live here. They've habitually traveled. So it's no different whether they're in London or in Johannesburg or in Plettenberg Bay. It's just all they've done is rebase themselves. And a lot of them have still retained interest, business interests here, or alternatively have cashed in their chips and taken their money all out, but retained, let's call it, some lifestyle assets here, a holiday home in Plett or Clifton or wherever. But their wealth has been fully hedged externally because of the rand. Don't forget, I mean, our listeners will know, you know, in the 60s, in the early 60s, for 100,000 rand, you got US$135,000. And as I say, kaiku lakula no. So you're talking about now 17 rand 30 to the dollar, and the rand's been actually quite actively strong recently. But so what's got to happen here? And you obviously, your party, the DA, is part of the GNU. I'm not so sure that the governing party is prepared to really share power properly. And until you've got service delivery, and service delivery doesn't happen in the union buildings. Service delivery happens in Rivonia Road. It happens in down, well, if I call it down, right down to the local government level. And until we've eradicated largely the cancers that are eating this country, be it corruption and crime, etc., which is all linked back to the point about the proper educational system, this country cannot, will never be able to actually grow to where it should be. As a beacon of prosperity and safety, which we all rightly deserve, all citizens of South Africa.
Okay, Eddie, I'm absolutely fascinated. I'm so pleased and so honored that you've been able to share this time with us this evening. Our time is now pressurizing me to start wrapping up, and I know our producers are getting a bit anxious. So thank you ever so much. I really appreciate it. It's been not only fascinating for me, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be able to send me emails, send me discussions. There might be one or two brickbats. I'll share that with you, of course. But I really appreciate it, and I thank you for everything that you're doing. Thanking you for the friendship that we've had over, what did you call it, 62
63,
years?
63.
63, yeah.
Don't leave the 1 year off.
I'm feeling a bit old, so I'll make it 62. But at the end of the day, thank you ever so much for spending your time with us. Thank you for everything that you're doing. And I wish everyone well over the fast. I'll see you tomorrow evening. I'm not going to sit next to you, if you don't mind, tomorrow evening, because the shul has moved me onto the other side. And I've had to cross the floor in the garden.
As long as you don't have to cross the floor in terms of your party. Yeah, but thank you, Bags, for inviting me onto the show. I really do appreciate it. And to all our listeners, as Jewish listeners, especially, of course, Gemar Chatima Tova, Tzom Kal, and a very meaningful fast, and a Shana Tova, a year, hopefully a year of peace and solidarity with Israel. Thank you.
Thank you. Keep well.